The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
Now on view at Skadfesh, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfesh.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. It was on this date, 92 years ago, that Martin Luther King Jr. was born. His birthday is observed as a national holiday on the third Monday in January, the only federal holiday designated as a national day of service. Atlanta takes special pride in Dr. King as a native son, and various sites in our city honor his legacy. Nicole A. Moore is the Director of Education for the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. Later this hour, she'll give us suggestions for a self-guided walking tour of landmarks specific to Dr. King's life and work. A meaningful way to observe the King holiday, mindful of pandemic safety. January 15th is also an important date for a pathbreaking Atlanta dance ensemble. It has been 30 years since Ballethnic Dance Company first performed their now iconic Urban Nutcracker in the King Chapel on the campus of Morehouse College. The ballet is an Atlanta holiday tradition, and it's streaming through January 19th. You can still view it. Nina Gilraith and Waverly Lucas founded Ballethnic with their inclusive vision of ballet. They join us now via Zoom, along with company ballerina Carla Tyson. Welcome back to City Lights.
Thank you.
Nina and Waverly, please tell us what motivated you to create this space for underrepresented classical dancers.
What was always interesting to me is that I came from a small hometown where I did not see little girls that looked like me that did ballet. So early on, I wanted to dance ballet. And then as I got older, I began to feel that it was my God-given call to be that example for others. So when we came to the Atlanta Ballet, and I started to see that there just needed to be another place of access, that's what started this change for us. I would say our revolution.
Yeah, for me, I think it started, I would say, at Mary Grove College. And people would always ask me what was my favorite form of dance. I would say sometimes ballet, sometimes African or ethnic dance. And, you know, that love of those two polar opposites really attracted me to want to really redefine what ballet could be or what ballet was in my own spirit, you know, sort of similar to how jazz musicians navigate their craft. We've done the same thing with ballet. because at times we've broken some of the barriers that are placed on ballet, or expanded them, should I say. And the same thing with African or ethnic dance form. I think we've taken a community approach. You feel that everyone should be involved. Everyone has something to share and offer within it. And so this is how we work as an organization.
Carla, we last spoke in 2017 when you were performing in the annual Urban Nutcracker. Would you talk about Ballethnic's adaptation of the classic Tchaikovsky ballet?
Sure. It has all of the same classical music. There is one song that was produced by L. Gerard Reed for the part of Russian, but everything is the same. Miss Nina and Miss Soevli just made it adapt to a different time period, and we changed some of the names of the characters to fit more of the urban community. And we have a lot of things that are reflective of like Atlanta. We have like Coca-Cola bottles and Coca-Cola dancers. So it's the same, but it's different.
And Lois, I would like to add with that, one of the focal points is the fact that our Nutcracker is based in the image of Marcus Garvey, and the soldiers are his Garveyite army. And so you have things like that. It's also based on Sweet Auburn Avenue. And you have a lot of historical points that, you know, basically is the foundation for it, as such as Yates and Milton's drugstores, where it takes place.
Yeah, tell us please about setting the Urban Nutcracker in 1940s Atlanta.
Yes, actually I was fortunate to have the opportunity to interview Father Henry Boughton, who I believe was the first African-American Episcopalian priest in Atlanta. You know, he was the grandfather of Gloria Boughton, who was our board director. And when I interviewed him, this man was so distinguished, and, you know, it's like it made me sit up so straight during the interview. And that's where I got the motivation for the character Professor Isaac, who's likely to the Drosselmeyer in the traditional Nutcracker. And so, you know, I think these are the things, by having embodied knowledge of speaking with, you know, having discourse with different, should I say, people that are relevant from that time period, allowed me to peer beyond just merely accepting the information that I received from the Apex Museum, for instance. I was able to delve deeper into it. And so that's what was important about it, I think.
It's interesting for me to hear you talk about Marcus Garvey. I didn't realize that his work and writing was an influence on the ballet.
Yeah, I think that's one of my reasons, because often people ignore African-American culture, especially if it's not prevalent. And I think, and this is our own community that I saw. And so for me, I feel that as an artist, it is up to us to expose our community and our young people to things that, you know, basically are not there generally. And this is what our art allows us to do.
Yeah, and at first glance, when I saw this setting was 1940s Atlanta. This is several years ago when I first became familiar with Urban Nutcracker. I thought, ooh, pre-Voting Rights Act, pre-Civil Rights Act. I wouldn't think 1940s Atlanta would have been a special time, but you present a very different picture of life in Sweet Auburn in the 1940s. Would you talk about that?
So in the 1940s, it was a very prosperous time on Sweet Auburn Avenue. It was one of the wealthiest avenues in America. So that was important for us to show a time in history that we were doing very well, and that Blacks, we were doing for ourselves. And to piggyback on what Waverly said in regards to the Marcus Garvey Nutcracker influence, it was all about doing for ourselves. We came up with founding Ballethnic at a time that we did not know about grants and about contributions. So we had to figure out a way to self-fund early on. And throughout most of our history, we've had to continually think about ways to help ourselves, or else we would not be here today. We understand that we don't do it alone and that our community is an important part of it. So in order to get the community to engage and to embrace what we were doing, it became an educational feat, because when you have working class people that may think that the arts are frivolous or might not know enough about it, we had to create something that people felt like they needed and wanted to be a part of it. So we created a community that reflected our values, our history, our entrepreneurialism, and all things that gave us power. And so when we first started Urban Nutcracker, everyone helped to paint the backdrop. We bought a big 30 by 40 piece of muslin, and we had Kevin Sipp, who's an artist.
Yes.
He helped us to draw what the background was going to be. And everybody chipped in with some paint, and we did that. All the families and parents brought in prom dresses to create the dresses for the party scene. We shopped at yard sales. So that is what's so community about what we do in the early years, when there was not the big level of resources and we were learning.
Well, you also have actively worked on providing community programs. Both of you have been dedicated to accessibility for low-income families in the Metro Atlanta area. Would you talk about some of those efforts, please?
Again, early on, we knew in order to include and to grow our brand, which we didn't think of it as a brand at that time, but to grow our family and to build the type of families that we came from. I come from North Carolina, where my community was very strong and we helped one another. We knew that we had to celebrate everybody in the community, and we definitely had to celebrate and include people that did not have the wherewithal or the money. So early on, anybody that wanted to dance, we accepted them into our space. And we don't believe in just giving things. We wanted people to understand the nobility of hard work and what that means. So if someone could contribute a quarter, a dollar, or whatever it is they had, or if it was the trade-off of work, we wanted everybody to have a skin in the game. And we still do that now with our work study program. That's how Waverly was able to build the Danceur Development Project for young men, was to bring them into this family environment and teach the guys through an athletic approach. That's how I was able to work with girls with Beyond the Bar programming to bring them in as well. Because we're in COVID now, it's tougher, of course, to do the things that we once did pre-COVID. But early on, we traveled to all kinds of schools, all kinds of churches, community centers, like bringing what we do and making people understand that art and culture is very important and that it is a way of life, and that we as creatives are called just like every other profession. So I think in thinking and showing how we worked in that manner, it broke a lot of barriers, and it made people who ordinarily would think of dance, especially ballet, in a certain way go, oh, I mean, if I had a dollar for every time I heard people tell us, oh, I like that kind of ballet. I never liked it before, but I like y'all's kind of ballet. Wow, I would be pretty wealthy, but yeah.
Why do you think there is a stereotype among Black people not wanting to participate in classical ballet? Essentially, what led to ballet's lack of diversity?
Well, I think part of it, and that's an interesting question, because that is part of what my focus became in my thesis, my master's of ethnochoreology thesis at the University of Limerick of the Irish World Academy of Music and Dance. I focused on, you know, basically why what we do is relevant. I did a timeline, and it focused on three basic African-American Black companies: Ballethnic Dance Company, Dance Theater of Harlem, which is the oldest, and Collage Dance Collective. And basically, you know, it pointed out how you have three companies, black-based, classical-based companies, and basically all pretty much struggle. And that's, you know, when you look at the makeup of the African-American community and the financial status that's available, and just overall how, you know, you can only have three of these type of company, professional companies, and all still struggle. That says something. And I think part of it is the lack of inclusiveness of ballet. And, you know, whereas the one of the things I pointed out, how those two companies are more or less, they deal more with a traditional form of ballet, assimilating more white, stereotypically white organizations, whereas Balletnik has really focused on redefining, utilizing strong classical concepts, but daring to, you know, push those edges and to redefine ourselves to fly below the radar. And so, like I said, I don't think it was initially intended for us to do it. But just like with anything, as we mix, as we grow, Babatunde Olatunji told me something when I was working with him. He was like, no one can covet art or culture. He's like, it's to be shared. He's like, if you don't want it shared, you know, then you hide it away. He's like, and you can't hide it away, because once it's exposed, it is of the world. It's no longer yours. And that was a beautiful thing to me.
Waverly Lucas and Nina Gilraith, co-founders of Balletnik, with company ballerina Carla D. Tyson. We'll be back with more of this conversation after a short break. You're listening to WABE Atlanta.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Let's return to my conversation with the co-founders of Balletnik, Nina Gilraith and Waverly Lucas, along with company ballerina Carla D. Tyson. We've been discussing the importance of representation in classical ballet. Last month, I spoke with the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick. He has a new podcast called Being American. And for that podcast, he interviewed Misty Copeland, the first African-American woman promoted to principal dancer for American Ballet Theater. I asked Governor Patrick what struck him most about her rise to success, and he said her bravery. It's not until you really appreciate how much going into becoming a principal, but how staked the odds are against you if you are Black, particularly in classical ballet. What are your thoughts on that statement?
Well, for me, the reason I got into dance was because I loved to move and I had all these influences, but ballet was just something that I felt like I could do and it was really beautiful. So initially you get into dance because you just like the art form, and then all of a sudden you look around and go, hey, all the rooms that I walk in, I'm one of the only ones or one of the few ones. Or when you start to see that casting comes up and you're relegated to certain parts, or you have to fight for every part. Then I started to realize, wow, there's a greater battle that's happening. And am I willing and do am I able to endure and persist through this battle? And I chose that I could. I felt like I could have the tools. And for me, mostly, is that I felt like if I fought hard enough, the next generation would have a better opportunity. And here we are, we're still fighting. I remember before Mr. Mitchell passed away, Arthur Mitchell, the founder of Dance Theater of Harlem, he came to Atlanta to work with us. And one of the times I had the opportunity to drive him back to his hotel. And he said to me, he was like, I can't believe that I'm still saying the same thing 50 years later. And that really, wow, underscored something very powerful for me. It made me go, well, this is going to be what our life's fight is about. I want to stay in the game so that I can help make a way for people like Carla. And even with our smaller budget, we've been able to create working opportunity for brown and black dancers and other dancers, because we've had white dancers in our company as well, to work and to do what we do in a very excellent, in an excellent manner. So the fight continues. And as I get discouraged some days, I think about what Mr. Mitchell said to me, and it gives me a new juice. It gives me juice to even approach it in a regional effect, as I work in Athens now, also at the East Athens Educational Dance Center. So I know the battle is just, it's not one way. Having done it 30 years and at the 27th year, honestly, I almost gave up because so many things were stacked against us that Waverly and I knew we had to make a change. So it's more of a regional approach for us. And then we'll continue to spread out because we have this knowledge, this energy and desire, and why God still has given us enough strength. I want to be able to continue to preach the gospel of access through your art and through the art of dance and using that art to make change in other parts of the community and in your life.
Carla, you've been active in various forms of dance continually. You were a participant on the TV show So You Think You Can Dance in season 8. You were a Laker girl for the Los Angeles Lakers for 3 seasons, which really is a dance team. You did that before returning to Ballethnic. What made you decide to return to the company?
It's really weird while I was listening to Miss Nina talk. I did do a few like ballet performances while I was in LA. I did like someone's Nutcracker version and like an Alice in Wonderland. And it was at some point where I was taking class, I was like, I could like stay here, but I thought about the fact that I would basically have to start all over. And by that point, I was already older than probably most of the people I would probably be, quote unquote, like fighting against for like certain parts or certain privileges, I guess. And I just was like, I don't want to do that. I just felt like I was too old. And I guess my mind, I thought I accomplished either more than what they have or just accomplished too much for myself that I didn't feel like I wanted to start all over. So I just decided to pack up after I was done with Lakers and just decided to come back home. And I'm thankful that Mr. Waverly and Ms. Nina decided to take me back and I can continue my professional ballerina career at Ballethnic until I decide to hang them up.
Nina and Waverly, what are your thoughts on having various body types and physiques participating in ballet?
Yeah, I have a lot of indifference about that because I've seen some incredible dancers get overlooked because of this so-called ideal body type. And you know, I've always had the philosophy, I guess that's part of the blend with the African culture, that there's no such thing as the wrong body type. It's more or less the wrong spirit and the wrong work ethic. You know, that matters more to me because I've seen just some incredible dancers completely, you know, dismissed. And there were some that we've had Amy Harold, she was one who came, we got from University of Georgia dance department. And she danced with us for over 10 years. And she was incredible. But she didn't have that stereotypical body type.
Which is what? Right here.
The thin, long lines, you know, basically, you know, flat behind, you know, that's just part of it. You know, Nina didn't have that. But then, you know, her talent was undeniable. Same thing with Carla. I watch this constantly with the Black ballerinas, whereas being a Black male in dance, it's different because there, you know, of course, because of my strength and everything, I'm used differently. So there's a value, you know, whereas I have many other options often in the ballet world. Whereas the ballerinas, Black ballerinas, they're very few. And even though many of them are so far much more talented than us, than the males sometimes.
So what do you think can lead to greater diversity in ballet? Do you think diversity training in ballet schools? How do you change people's attitudes?
I really believe that the ballet world is a microcosm of society as a whole. And I think what we're doing is we're seeing it. There are times where we kind of glance over it and say, oh, well, that's back then. You're holding on to things. And that's easy to say when you're not experiencing it on a daily basis, you know? And so I think this is what it is. I don't look at the ballet world really any differently than the real world. And in society, this is what, you know, what we deal with. You know, it's real. What you see is what you get.
So that is why representation of BIPOC Black dancers in classical dance settings is so important for younger audiences to see.
Absolutely. And even more importantly is that we go beyond the assimilation of the stereotypical white dance genre and really redefine what classicism is, because we have our own form of classicism, which is based on elegance, beauty, grace, and those concepts.
Yes. The 31st anniversary of the founding of Ballet Ethnic Dance Company is today. Clearly, your mission of informing, educating, and entertaining through dance has come to fruition, as well as using your art to impact the community with programs that act as a catalyst for social change. Do you have new goals for this coming year?
Yeah, in fact, our new goal is our old goals. We want to continue to do fantastic, innovative, exciting work. And one of the projects that we're working on is collaborating with the Bremen Museum to create a production of dance that goes with the art that they have up of Herbert Schnitzer. We're really excited about that because it really pays homage to jazz artists. And as I've talked with Waverly about this, I feel like we embody a lot of the sentiments of jazz artists and how we've had to be improvisational and work through so many different elements to stay afloat, to stay alive, to work really hard to be in the game. So I'm very excited about that. We've also worked with Perkins and Will, and they've come up with this fantastic reimagining of our space in East Point. So we'll be going into a capital campaign to first start with our outdoor amphitheater. We have a little stage outside now, but we want to expand that. So I'm really excited because as COVID hit, one of the first things we did was to have an outdoor cultural cul-de-sac coming together at our space. So now we'll be able to do it even better and greater. And then we want to impact the next generation by mentoring the next set of leaders, business-wise and artistically. So I have many mentees right now, And again, while I have this energy and excitement, I want to pour into as many people that want to learn what we have to offer and to help them with this path so it won't be as difficult as our path. And, you know, always for me, work is the champion. So if people have that spirit of working in excellence, I'm ready to join hands with others and help lead the way. So ultimately, Ballethnic will get its new vision, its new leadership, but we want to help show the way.
Nina Gilraith and Waverly Lucas, co-founders of Ballethnic Dance Company. They were joined by company ballerina Carla D. Tyson. You can find more information about the ensemble and their upcoming events on our website, wabe.org/citylights. It was on this date, 92 years ago, that Martin Luther King Jr. was born. His birthday is observed as a national holiday on the third Monday in January, the only federal holiday designated as a national day of service. In Atlanta, we take special pride in Dr. King as a Native son. And here to tell us about some meaningful local places to explore on this King holiday is Nicole A. Moore, Director of Education for the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. Nicole, welcome to City Lights.
Thank you for having me.
Mindful of safety during the pandemic, we hope you can suggest various sites related to MLK that might help us form a self-guided tour. Before that, I was hoping you would give us a brief overview of his years in Atlanta.
Absolutely. Dr. King was born here in Atlanta in 1929. He was raised here. He lived with his family, his mother, his father, his sister, and his brother. Their house is still standing. It's part of the national park, which I do believe is currently closed. But it, even just standing outside of it and realizing, like, this is where Dr. King grew up is pretty extraordinary. He went to Booker T. Washington High School here in Atlanta. And then he matriculated to go to Morehouse College at the age of 15. So like his formative years are really spent in the heart of Atlanta. And I always tell people one of the greatest places to kind of really connect with, you know, what would have it been like, or just to be in the places where Dr. King walked and talked and grew up, is to really walk down Auburn Avenue and just kind of rest in that, because that was his neighborhood. That was the environment that he was around. And it's really amazing to know this house that looks kind of small from the outside, but when you go inside, it is surprisingly massive. This is where he grew up. This is where he, you know, learned lessons from his mother and his father. This is where he was with his grandparents. And it's an everyday place. And it just gets you to realize that greatness can come from anywhere.
Oh, yes. I read that he was born Michael Luther King Jr. Do we know why he changed his name?
So his father changed his name as well after Martin Luther. And so they went from being Michael Kings to Martin Luther Kings, both senior and junior. This happened, I want to say, when Dr. King, it's really funny calling him Dr. King,
I know,
talking about him as a child, but this is around like the age of five. So, you know, they found inspiration in Martin Luther and they wanted to change their names, and they did. And a lot of people, you know, I'll say, you know, Michael King, and they're like, well, who is that? It's like, let's back it up to the birth certificate. Let's back it up a little bit further and let you know a secret about him, is that his name wasn't always Martin.
You mentioned that MLK was a Morehouse man. He entered college at the young age of 15. He wrote in his autobiography that it was the first place he ever had a frank discussion about race. Would you talk about how attending Morehouse was transformative for MLK?
Absolutely. He had, you know, had incidences around race growing up with his father. But it's when he, you know, left home, goes to Morehouse, that they're having these really hard and intellectual conversations about race. And that's where his thoughts around race and social justice really start to matriculate. That's where he's able to be exposed to folks like Henry Davis Thoreau and his on civil disobedience. That's where he is mentored by people like Dr. Benjamin Mays. That's where he's really able to grasp the concept of what it means to be Black in America, where he gets to see that, you know, the injustice isn't just relegated to the Southern states, that it's everywhere, and that this is an illness of the country that needs to be remedied. And so this time at Morehouse, he really is forming his thoughts on, all right, how do I operate in this landscape? Who are my allies in this? And how can we overturn the system? And, you know, it could be very philosophical starting off as a college undergrad, but this is something that stays with him, and it eventually becomes his life work. That seed that was planted with interactions with his father is something that really, really blooms in his time at Morehouse.
At what point in his life did Martin Luther King Jr. begin to get involved with actions against racial inequality?
So that pivotal moment where we see King become an activist, I would have to say, is in Montgomery in 1955. When he's elected president of the Montgomery Improvement Association. He was just starting out his role as pastor at Dexter Baptist Church. He was aware, he was active with the NAACP, but it's when you have the bus boycott with Rosa Parks, led by the Women's Political Council, that King is seriously just thrust into the limelight and into this life of activism. And it's something that, it wasn't a foreign idea to him. He had had these conversations. Part of his and Mrs. King's relationship was about social activism and their conversations around that. And I think he was probably like, you know, new family, new location. Let me just kind of see how things are. And members of that community were like, nah. You're going to be the guy that takes us to the next level. That is really when he embraces this idea of social change. And using the pulpit as a method to spread the word, but also to ensure that we're practicing nonviolence, that we're practicing civil disobedience that still kind of follows the rule of law, but it takes a stand.
Yes, nonviolent social change. If someone wanted to create their own tour, a self-guided tour of historic sites in Atlanta related to Dr. King, where would you recommend beginning?
I would honestly probably start at the home site.
Still.
I would start there because that is where it all begins. I would really just kind of see the neighborhood that he grew up in. The houses there are the shotgun houses across the street. They're pretty preserved, just to see kind of the landscape. I would recommend walking down Auburn Avenue, really, and just imagine it before the highway was there, seeing how this was his community, right? This is where you had residential Black life in downtown Atlanta, but then you cross over into the business realm of Black Atlanta, and you see places like the Atlanta Life Building, you see the Repository, you see the Atlanta Daily World, those buildings, and understand that for us today, it just kind of looks like, oh, these are some old buildings, but it really encapsulates the Black experience in so many cities. Like, we had businesses, we had social centers, we had religion, we had banking, we had what we needed because this was the only place that we could be accepted. And really walking up and down Auburn Avenue and seeing how it's changed, but also how those threads of history are still there, to me, it's such a grounding point because we get to understand how change did happen And when you look at the highway, you realize that it cuts right through that neighborhood and it separates it from the business district to the residential district. When it was okay to really be outside, we would do a couple of walks up and down Auburn Avenue and just really seeing that and seeing how so much has changed. It put in perspective why we should value Black history and why we should value the history in our neighborhoods. And so I would say if somebody was like, well, what can I do that's relatively safe? Grab a jacket, bundle up, walk up and down Auburn Avenue. It's about a mile, but see Wheat Street, see Ebenezer, see Big Bethel, and realize how much of Atlanta's Black culture rested within that corridor.
The King Center for Nonviolent Social Change houses many wonderful artifacts related to MLK. Outdoors, what do visitors see in Freedom Plaza?
In Freedom Plaza, I think one of the most, two of the striking things that exist are the Eternal Flame that's there, but then also the crypt, which ends up being the final resting place for Dr. King and Mrs. King. And it is a moment of reflection. It's a moment of gratitude, really. Particularly these two individuals really dedicated their adult life to providing methods to which we can move about the world today. And I think it's important to kind of just stop and think, like, what would the world have been like had there not been a Dr. King? Yes, there were other activists who did incredible things. And so it's those moments where you realize, well, what would have it looked like? But also just to say thank you, like, thanks so much. And to remember that we are a part of Dr. King's beloved community. Whether we have actually come together fully, we're still working on that part. But we recognize that when he was talking about the World House, when he was talking about the beloved community, he was talking about every person looking out for each other, working together. And I think just being in that moment outside, when you see that eternal flame, for me, it's a reminder that the work will never be finished, but it's also just a moment to say thank you for what you've given us, and let's carry the torch forward.
Located on historic Auburn Avenue, of course, is Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Dr. King, his father and grandfather preached. And now our senator-elect, Reverend Raphael Warnock, preaches there. This church has a beautiful as well as tragic history. What role did Ebenezer Baptist Church play in Dr. King's life?
I mean, it was his grandfather's church, right?
Yeah.
And so he grew up in this church. His father becomes co-pastor, and then he eventually becomes co-pastor. And it really is, I think, the foundation of how he engaged the community. It's the foundation of what he found to be important. It's also kind of that grounding of his faith. And when you're in old, I always differentiate between old Ebenezer and new Ebenezer, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're in old Ebenezer, kind of seeing how small the sanctuary actually is, and thinking about the historic sermons that have come out of that space, that have come off of that pulpit, but also thinking of the moments in history that it has seen, I see Ebenezer as a place for, again, understanding how religion shapes the Black experience and what grounds many of us in the continued fight. So I would look at Ebenezer as just kind of this, it's a balm, right? It is the place that we go when we're hurting. It's the place that we go when we are joyful. It soothes our souls. And to understand that for Dr. King, that was almost a second home. It is the place where he found, can't say definitively, but it's probably one of those places where he found solace, where he knew, you know, his largest critics would be, but also his largest supporters would be, because they're the ones that are going to keep him honest, that they're the ones that are going to keep him real, because they knew him. They knew him from when he was a child to when he was an adult. And unfortunately for some of those congregants, they knew him in his death by being at his funeral. And I think for him, that is the place where he probably could go and reset to re-energize himself so that he could continue to carry out the work in other cities.
Nicole, you are a public historian. Would you tell us some of the educational initiatives that you lead at the Center for Civil and Human Rights?
Absolutely. So I am responsible for our K through 12 initiatives. So your school experiences, presentations, just really educating our young people on the roles of activism in the civil rights movement, but also looking at the human rights movement on a global level and how these fights aren't unique to the United States. So helping students really kind of understand how we got here. I know that's a question that a lot of people have been asking lately. So looking at how segregation and Jim Crow leads to this fight for equality, which gives us the civil rights movement and a lot of grassroots organizing. But then also how those battles and how that fight for equal rights in the United States served as inspiration for movements across the globe and how there's so much work to be done. So getting the students to really see that, okay, maybe you aren't looking at how to integrate a shoe store, but where do you see somebody's rights being violated? Let me show you some examples of your historical peers that were taking a stand, that were creating change, not just for their communities, but realizing there was a ripple effect. I love doing that with the babies because they get it, right? And unfortunately, we left them with a world where they don't get to relax too much. And so making sure that they have the knowledge, that they have the history, that they have the context is something that I absolutely love doing with the team and ensuring that when we watch the next generation, we know that we've given them the best that we could. And so far, the babies are running with it. Quite proud.
That's pretty heartening. How long have you been with this center?
I've been with the center for 5 going on 6 years now.
Well, it sounds like they are very fortunate to have your talent. Would you talk about the Morehouse College MLK collection? What's offered there?
Sure. So we are actually, the interesting thing about this year is that because of COVID, we had to shut down and we had just opened a wonderful exhibit looking at We Share the Dream and talking about Dr. King's beloved community. We're showing that exhibit again. One of the things that is going to make it really special this time is that we are actually creating it as a digital exhibit as well, because we recognize with COVID that a lot of people may not want to go out. Totally understood, respected, and honestly, I agree. But that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, that you'll miss out the opportunity to see this exhibit. And so we've digitized some of the pieces so that people can really see, when we talk about King's beloved community, it comes up in his Nobel Peace Prize speech. He talks about it a lot in sermons. Where do we go from here? Chaos or Community is really about the beloved community. It's his books. And so when people kind of get to understand as we hear discussions about a nation that needs healing, what does that look like? What does unity look like? People are trying to figure things out. This exhibit really kind of shows what it means to care for your fellow human being.
And this virtual event, We Share the Dream, will be on January 22nd?
Yes. And so what we decided to do was, with this exhibit, we invited a panel last year to really talk about the beloved community. We wanted to bring them back, those same panelists, to say, okay, it's been a year, right? And we have seen social unrest due to racial violence. We have seen the insurrection at the Capitol. We have seen a pandemic just bring us to our knees. What does this beloved community look like now? And how do we move forward in this moment with this idea and this philosophy of a beloved community?
So do you know who will be on the panel?
Sure. Dr. Laura Solstice, who is the executive director of Freedom University, and Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza, who is the founder of the Activist Theology Project, to come back on January 22nd at noon to reexamine a year later, you know, what does a beloved community look like? And so we are very fortunate to be able to do this virtually, and it will tie directly into the exhibit, really just a revisitation. And hopefully when people who have seeing the exhibit in person, but they also engage with it digitally, they'll look at it differently because of what 2020 presented us with.
Yeah. I loved your description of how the babies get it when you were talking about the K through 12 students who come through and leave the Center for Civil and Human Rights inspired and in awe. Why is it important that young activists aspire to be like Dr. King when they're seeking to implement change in their own communities?
I think it's important for them to look at Dr. King and the John Lewis's and the Joanne Robinsons and all of those civil rights icons, because they started out young. John Lewis was a teenager when he started. And, you know, they tend to see just Dr. King as an adult. They tend to see John Lewis as an adult. But what they need to realize is that this was a life of work. It didn't come easy. And they're not alone in this. Like, people have laid a blueprint for them down. And to just see that when they're weary or when they're like, I don't know if anything's going to come of this, to really have these figures to look back on, to see their struggles, to see their successes, but also to see their failures, to know that it's okay if you make a mistake, you have to get back up, you have to keep moving. I think that's what's so important. Not striving for perfection, but understanding that this is an ongoing struggle and this is ongoing work is critical. It's important not to give up. And it is important to really have a hard conversation. Like, you know, do you want to do this? Do you want to do this for a little while? Do you want to do this for a long time? Is this a lifetime of service or is this a moment of service? And it's okay if you're like, hey, you know what? I'm good here. I'm going to do something else in a couple of years. But just to realize that they're not the first and they won't be the last. And having those figures to look back to and then realizing that in a couple of years, another generation is going to be looking at them, you know, it provides encouragement.
Nicole A. Moore, Director of Education at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. More information about their virtual MLK event on January 22nd can be found on our website, wabe.org/citylights. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of Atlanta arts and cultural life. Monday at 11 a.m., we'll bring you a special program in observance of the King holiday, MLK and the Fierce Urgency of Now. City Lights returns Tuesday at 11 a.m. Our theme music is The First Time, written and performed by Joe Grandston with his jazz band. Special thanks to Hot Shoe Records. City Lights producers are Summer Evans and Ryan McFadden. Kevin Rinker is our engineer, and I'm Lois Reitzis. I would just so love it if you would follow me on Twitter at LoisReitzes. Have a safe and good weekend. Thanks for listening to WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. and thank you.